Warning, The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
Turns out that Barry Obama actually tried to negotiate with the mullahs before they were shooting protesters in the street. He said, be nice, give up your plans to dominate the world with atomic weapons, destroy Israel, take on the great Satan. And that's why he's gone soft on the Iranian mullahs and Ahmadinejad, is because there's a letter went out where he said that he wanted to negotiate with them. The fact is, now we know who Ayatollah Ali Khamenei is. If you didn't know who it was, you know who he is now. And that is, they shoot protesters. I mean, you remember the movie They Shoot Horses, don't they? Well, in Iran, they shoot protesters, don't they? And Obama should have said something much sooner, but he didn't. And, of course, the press corps covered for him, just as they wouldn't ask him a thing about North Korea, while that, unfortunately, continues to escalate. But the left, as you well know, is suicidal. And they feel that their game plan is to do anything that Bush didn't do. They think that's foreign policy. To the left, to do the opposite of what Bush did or would have done is their idea of foreign policy. They don't actually think about the effects of their decisions. All they say is, let's see, what would Bush do? Let's do the opposite. Because that's how children think. So here we have a president who's acting like a child. And he has people around him who apparently don't know who they're dealing with. You've got bloodshed, you've got fraud, you've got a ballot stuffing, and the man still clings to his hope of talking Iran out of its nuclear program. And that's why he said there was little difference between Ahmadinejad and Mousavi. That's why he said there's no point in arguing about it. He's still pursuing the absurdity of the college professor who wants to pursue diplomacy. Obama should have acted with the moral imperative. That's what he should have done. I don't believe Obama has any idea what foreign policy is all about. I believe he is hard-focused only on pushing a domestic Marxist agenda. Because remember, if they can get through the socialized medicine that has been the high point of his dreams for his entire life, you got to understand something about far leftists. Their number one priority has always been health care, for every reason you can imagine. It's very expensive, and it's a way to control people from the cradle to the grave. If you've got to go to Big Daddy in the government for every aspect of your health care, from the time you are born until the time you die, they have you where they want you. They have all your medical records. They can manipulate you. They can blackmail you, whatever they want to do. And that's why Obama is hard-focused on getting socialized medicine passed as soon as possible. And right after that, after he passes this $3 trillion boondoggle, he's going to try to grant amnesty to 30 million illegal aliens. I don't know how you don't see what he's doing to the country. The man is incapable of dealing with foreign affairs, foreign policy, because he's focused only on a domestic Marxist agenda. That's my opinion. The article on cyanide-laced fruit killing rare elephants is a heartbreaker. I don't know how you can see that and not get crazy from it. I do. That's why I donate to the Elephant Preservation Funds and the Gorilla Fund. Imagine they cut the hands off, the paws off mountain gorillas. I can't believe it, what goes on in the world. In China, they take bears and they torture them in front of people for sport. And we think we can negotiate with the third world. You hear that? And it's like Obama trying to talk to the mullahs of Iran and Ahmadinejad. While they're shooting protesters in the street, Obama's holding out talking like Neville Chamberlain. But because he has the press in his pocket, thus far Obama can get away with this. It's astounding to me. Not one word about North Korea. It was shocking, actually. You know, I knew when I studied history, I learned what a state-controlled media is. The state-controlled media only gives you the government's point of view, right? You tell me ABC, CBS, NBC, and CNN are not state-controlled media? What's the difference between the people in those companies and how they react to Obama and what they cover for him and what they cover up for him and a state-controlled media? Tell me how it would be any different. You don't think there's a threat from North Korea? I don't think that the maniac can destroy America, but he could launch a rocket, for example, with biological weapons on it that might just land in Hawaii or, God forbid, in Alaska or Hawaii. Isn't that a threat? Don't you think that our Navy should blow up the ship carrying weapons right like now, yesterday, the day before? It is his missile crisis, Obama, but because he's so busy trying to pass socialized medicine, his fellow travelers in the media are covering for him. That's what it comes down to. Daryl in Houston, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Thank you, Dr. Savage. I was just wanted to make the comment because I listen to y'all's shows all the time, and just wanted to say that, you know, the reason that a lot of people are so happy with what they're getting from Obama is because they were all looking for a handout and looking for something for nothing.
And that's absolutely right. Many of them celebrated and said, now we're going to have the cars and the houses that you have. I heard it from cops in Florida who told me that the criminals that they normally were pursuing were looking at them staring in their faces and say, we're going to be wearing your uniform soon. They told it to me.
That doesn't surprise me. Like I said, they're all looking for something for nothing, the easy way out, and that's exactly what this world's turning to. Nobody wants to work for anything anymore. They want to give.
Well, I wouldn't say nobody. I mean, you work, I work, and millions of listeners to this show work. Thank you for the call. New York City, WOR, Ilya, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Hey, Dr. Savage, I'm so happy to talk to you. I called about the cop in New York. I know it seems really unfair, busted with that MP3 player, but is it possible that maybe karma has come into play and maybe he's done bad things in the past and now he's having to pay for it?
I don't know. I'm not God. Only God would know about karma.
Sometimes that happens. I mean, a lot of times people...
In other words, anybody who suffers is getting their just rewards?
I believe in karma, and I think sometimes...
So you think all children with cancer are being rewarded for with suffering for their past lives?
No, I don't believe in past lives, but I
believe... Oh, you just said you believe in karma. So what is karma? What does that mean?
Well, you know, it's possible maybe that cop's done bad things to other people, and...
Well, you just said that he's getting punished for things he did in the past, and you believe in karma. And I would like to ask you, what's the karma for the 22 years of service he's performed for the city risking his life? Wouldn't that sort of help some of his karmic balance sheet?
Only God knows what his karmic balance sheet is.
That's what I just said. Only God knows. See, I used to believe in some of this stuff till you actually think about it. Karma. Rubbish. Third world rubbish, the idea of karma. It's like, you know, mumbo jumbo from the people who left their religions, their Western religions, and picked up like ersatz Eastern religionism. Then karma suddenly covers everything. Oh, yeah, man, that's karma. Peace be with you. What does karma mean?
Karma.
How does that work? So if you go in a cancer ward, a children's cancer ward, they're being paid back for what they did when? Between infancy and age 2?
I know.
Or in a past life?
Oh, that's terrible.
See? And the elephants having their trunks cut off after being poisoned. What, are they reincarnated bad guys from somewhere?
Bastards.
Yeah. See, you got to think these things through. There's no such thing as karma. I mean, what goes around comes around. I heard that. I mean, all this hippie garbage. I lived through it all, you know. The one adage that really works is do unto others as you would have them do unto you. It's the one adage that really works for all religions. You can boil every religion on the earth down to that one phrase. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Or if you want to be negative, do not do unto others, blah, blah, blah. But I was laying in bed this morning thinking about that one, and I said, why don't you just change your thinking just slightly and see if your life doesn't get better, Michael. I said, why don't you do this one? Think of others as you would have them think of you. I said, wow, that's a new one. In other words, I've heard of do unto others as you would have them do unto you. That we all know. So you don't cheat, you don't lie, you don't steal, whatever, right? But what about think of others as you would have them think unto you? Now, that starts to borderline almost on liberal platitudes in a certain way. I understand that, meaning if you put out positive thoughts to your worst enemy, the worst enemy is going to think positive thoughts of you. That's what Obama's doing. He's thinking positively about the Hitler of Iran, thinking that the Hitler of Iran will like him for it. He's trying this liberal approach to things, the Dr. Spock approach to world affairs. He's testing the waters. So, in other words, if he were alive, when Hitler were alive, you would be speaking German or you'd be a lampshade. Your children would have been made into lampshades by the Nazis if we had had a president like this in 1939, 1940. He would have gotten up with a press conference, and the stooges at ABC, CBS, and NBC wouldn't have asked him about Hitler's invasion of Czechoslovakia, Poland, because the president would have been trying to pass a health care reform bill, and the dummies certainly are in line with that, so let's not ask him an embarrassing question. And Hitler then would have gone one step further. And he was again, remember, Obama's against missile defense programs. Meanwhile, he authorized Gates to move missile defense into his old state of Hawaii. How does that work? I'll be right back. In my time, if you wanted a good job, any kind of job or anything, you had to fight for it. If someone said, I won't hire you, you sat on their doorstep and showed them that you weren't about to give up so easily. You said, look, think about it again. Over and over again, you sat there. You didn't take no for an answer. You called them again and again until you got through to them. Then you begged them to see you, saying, I know that you've turned me down. I respect that, but I must tell you something you don't know about me. Usually, the boss of a company would have you come in saying, this person is very persistent. Maybe I should see them again. You refused to accept rejection in my day because accepting it made you a reject. You hear this? If you accepted rejection, you became a reject. But call anyone a reject today, and suddenly they go into therapy, and they might even sue you for hate talk. Now, is this the reason why politicians claim that illegal aliens aren't doing the jobs that Americans won't do? In my day, there weren't jobs that Americans wouldn't do. They were thankful if they got a job as a janitor, and they took pride in their work. Today, they expect to be president of the company within a month of arriving. And I'm going to ask you, what did you have to do to get where you are today? Maybe some young person will be saved by your story. What struggles did you have to go through to achieve a position in life that you have today, and how long did it take? I want to remind you of something else. When I was very young and just came out of college, I was a welfare worker, meaning in the New York Department of Welfare. I don't know what they call it today, something else. Then it was called the Welfare Department. Today it's called something else. Then I worked as a teacher. Then I worked as an editor in a book company. I didn't last very long because I wasn't a good editor. And the manager came, the editor-in-chief called me, and he said, Michael, I've got bad news for you. You're a nice person, but you're not an editor. You can't. We're going to fire you, but I'm going to give you a choice. And this is a true story. I never remember telling this one. He said, we're not going to fire you if you'll take a job starting on the very bottom. I'm going to give you a broom every day, and you have to start every day by sweeping up in editors' rooms. You know what I said to him? I'll take it. And do you know that I took that broom and I diligently swept the floors in that editor's office and in the assistant editor's office and the associate editor's office? I don't know how many months I did it, but eventually I became a junior editor in a very, very small, obscure publication. So you see, rejection is part of growth. Unfortunately, in America today, rejection is verboten. And look at the results we have. And so remember the purpose of this story. It's a positive purpose. The purpose of this story is to tell the young people listening to this show that the sale begins when the customer says no. Los Angeles, KGIL, Mark, you're up. Savage Nation, go ahead.
Your comments about rejection reminded me of the day I became a stockbroker. I didn't have a job. They had 1,500 applicants. I walked into the manager's office with a suit, told him I wanted to be a stockbroker, and he sat me down and he said to me, you must love rejection. I said, what are you talking about? He said, in this business, in your first year, 98% of the people you talk to are going to say no to you. But
right.
Those 2% that say yes are going to make your career. So you better
love... But Mark, you're from a different time. Like I said, I learned the sale begins when the customer says no. You learn from your boss that you have to accept 98% rejection. You're only focused on a 2% acceptance. Today the kids are told, oh, you should have full self-esteem even if you fail.
That's absolutely right.
That's all. All right. There's nothing new in that. I'm just saying I don't know how these kids can expect to have a job. You say one word to them, oh, right away. Go home to mommy and call a lawyer. Oh, it's amazing the country I'm living in. You know, I'm very observant. I'm bicycling today down to the mall. I see a lot of things wherever I go. Like, for example, I bought a taco for, I don't know what's it called, in Baja Fresh. I gave up. I didn't even want to think about what I wanted today. So two tacos, fish tacos, $8, $6.99, a soda. The bill was like $8. So I give the kid 20, and I look at it. The tax is like 80 cents in California. So I threw him a buck. He was very happy because who gives a dollar in a fast food place? And he's very nice and getting a little Spanish, this and that. Figured why not encourage the kid, you know. So I thought about it. I said I gave them a dollar tip in a takeout joint, but 80 cents went to the wonderful state of California who taxes me 10% a year on my income tax, and everything I buy, 9%. Where does the money go? The roads are broken. The bums are littering the streets. The politicians are robbing the treasury. Where are the services in the state? Now, that 80 cents I pay the state, I would rather have given another half a buck to the kid behind the counter, but it went to the state. Where does it go, though, you know? Now, then I bicycle back up before getting in the car and driving over the bridge, and I see a little house being finished that they were building. I like to watch the houses go up. They're still building a little here and there, overpriced like crazy. They're never going to sell it. I noticed that there were two white boys. There was a white guy who was the contractor. All the artisans were from Mexico or Central America. They were the artisans. And the white boys were digging ditches. And I said to myself, there's a story here too. What's the story? The Mexicans and Central Americans are hard workers, and they learned a trade. They learned how to be a carpenter, a plumber, an electrician. And the white boys learned nothing in school except how to put a condom on a cucumber and what racism and homophobia is and that America's no good. And they wind up with a fork, with a pitchfork in their hand, digging a ditch because they were not fit for anything else. That's the product of liberal education.
Savage.
See, leadership means meddling. Leadership requires thought. Leadership requires a speech that encourages the opposition while not provoking a militant reaction that's even worse. That's leadership. That's skill. Obama doesn't have the skill to inject himself into the Iran situation. What do you mean not productive to be seen meddling? I never heard of anything like this. We've gone from the light of the world into something else, the whoopee cushion of the world. That's all. We've gone from being seen as the light unto the world, democracy, to the whoopee cushion of the world with this guy in the White House. Ed, Fort Lauderdale, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Hey, Dr. Savage. You know, when I first graduated high school, I didn't go to college, and I told my father he owned a small construction company, and he was making pretty good money. I told him I wanted to do what he did. I wanted to be the boss. He told me, no, you have to come out and work as a laborer. So I told him, no, you know, I want to get a fancy truck and ride around like you and be the boss. He started laughing at me, and he told me, get out of here. And I actually went to work for one of his friends on a crew that put in sidewalks every day. And I was one of those guys that I dug ditches, I laid pipes. And when I actually got good enough and knew what I was doing, then I went to work for my father when I actually became part of the competition. And now I'm curious.
How many years did you work for the competition?
About 5 or 6 years.
That's very interesting because I read a story about 10 years ago that family businesses should not take their children into the business until they have worked for a competitor for 3 to 5 years.
When I started, I was a laborer. We put in sewer pipes and water pipes. you know, in big ditches. And when I started, I was the dummy who used to go and get all the pipes and bring them to the skilled people that knew how to put install the pipes. After my first year and a half there, I just caught right on to this kind of stuff. I was mechanically inclined. That's something they used to say. They don't say that anymore.
Yeah.
I was mechanically inclined. So, I went from being the dummy on the top of the ditch to running a crew with my own little crew within 2 years. And then I went out and I started actually competing with my father's company. And we actually started taking jobs away from him. And his friends would call up and say, hey, I got your son on my job. He's doing a great job. And actually, I didn't go to work for him right away. I joined the Army after that, after about 5 years, because I figured it was something I needed to do. For my life experience, it was always something I wanted to do. And when I came out, my father said, are you going to come work for me now? And I said, yeah, okay, yeah, sure. And we've been working together ever since.
And what, today, Ed, you're running the company?
Yeah, yeah. And I think back, I didn't know what the hell I was talking about when I told my dad. He was so right. It's not even funny. I've heard you tell stories about those old Italian guys with the thick necks and the hair on the back of their hands. You describe my family. They're from Queens. They're from Brooklyn. They're from all over New York. You know, they tell you nice things, but in a very rough way. They're always looking out for you. That's love in my family.
That's right. You know what? Well, let me ask you something. When you did something wrong, did they say good job?
No, they definitely
no. I have a friend who's a wealthy guy and a very big benefit, a conservative and a philanthropist. He said he'd come home from school with a 98 on his report card. His father would say to him, why didn't you get 100? What happened to the other 2 points?
Exactly right. I would come home all happy. I got B's or I got a C. And my father would say, why are your grades so low? How come you didn't get A's? What's wrong with you?
And today, the kid would call up the Child and Family Services so that they could take the kid away for abuse.
Once, my younger brother once told my father threatened to slap him, and my brother said, if you do, I'm calling HRS. And my father said, well, in the time it takes them to get to this house, I'm going to kill you. I brought you in.
Is your father still around?
Yes, he is. God bless him. Yes, he is.
How old is he?
He's about 65, 66 years old.
Oh, he's a young guy. But is he retired?
He still works because, you know, he doesn't really have hobbies. I mean, he works. He likes to go out. He meets with the
It's interesting. You know, that's very interesting. I have no hobbies either, really, other than the boating or whatever. The reason I have no hobbies is I couldn't have time to develop them.
Yeah, I mean, my father says, you know, hobbies. That's for rich people. He says, you know, I was always busy working, trying to make money. And, you know, now we're doing okay and everything's all right. But, Dr. Savage, could I just like to say something about President Obama saying not to meddle? Remember when John F. Kennedy told people we'll go anywhere, do anything to support freedom and democracy, and Ronald Reagan told the people of Poland, stand up and you'll have a friend in America? That's leadership. You know, tear down this wall, that's leadership. Not telling people we're not going to meddle.
Right. This guy is a pacifist socialist of the classic variety. He's following in the footsteps of Neville Chamberlain, who acquiesced to Hitler's aggression. And we know what followed as a result of acquiescing to the dictator called Hitler. I am terrified every day I wake up. I'm afraid to turn the computer on to see what these monsters are going to do next. They know that they're no longer having to worry about the United States of America. And I'm afraid that they're going to take a shot at us very soon.
Well, weakness breeds contempt in this world with all of these thugs and these dictators. Just today, I mean, I it was amazing. I was actually eating lunch with my father in a restaurant. They had the news on, and I saw that our president met with the leader of South Korea and reaffirmed that we're actually still their allies. I mean, that's amazing. Meanwhile, he wants to meet with Hugo Chavez.
What does he mean by that? He's still our ally. But what does that mean? He's still our ally. What did he say to him? I saw the speech. He's still our ally, but what is he doing about North Korea threatening to nuke them? Nothing. Wait, play clip 11. Hey, Ed, hold on. That's a great call. Play clip 11. I know what he's talking about.
The Republic of Korea is one of America's closest allies. Our friendship has been forged through a history of shared sacrifice, and it is anchored in our shared democratic values.
All right, fine. Oh, yeah, we understand all the highfalutin college talk, but you're no longer a professor, Mr. Obama. So let's see when it gets tough now. Let's hear clip 14.
There is another path available to North Korea.
See?
A path that leads to
Hold
peace.
Hold it. Stop right here. See the positive reinforcement? These people are trying to use Dr. Spock's methodology with North Korea, with Iran, with China, and with Russia. Give them the positive, and they'll follow you. No, my friends, these are not children in a little red schoolyard house. These are dictators who are laughing at you. Play clip 14. Listen to this.
There is another path available to North Korea, a path that leads to peace and economic opportunity for the people of North Korea, including full integration into the community of nations.
Oh, please.
That destination can only be reached through peaceful negotiations that achieve...
Okay, fine. That's all well and good. But what do you think the dictator of North Korea thinks when he hears this kind of college talk? He spits at it, and he'll go ahead and do what he wants, just like Ahmadinejad has been doing. Just as any dictator does. They do it because they can do it, and they do it because they can get away with it. Yeah, I believe in the carrot. But where's the stick? The stick should have been, all right, here's the positive. The negative is, unless you do it by Friday at 5 o'clock, we're going to blow up your launch pads, Johnson. I'll be right back.
Savage.
There's a left-wing fanatic in the New York Times named Frank Rich. Predictable columns, boring. He's the Barney Frank of the New York Times. So who does he salute? He salutes Shepard Smith of the Fox News Network, because Shep Smith is saying he's getting a lot of hate mail now for being so middle of the road. And he holds up Shepard Smith as the kind of conservative that he respects, that he could do business with. So in other words, anyone who's a real conservative is a fascist. Anyone who's a fraud like Shep Smith is suddenly a respectable man to the Bonnie Franks of the world. You get how this works? Well, let me tell you something. I'm not going to suddenly change my tune because they want me to. I see what's going on here. Obama, in a few months, has almost dismantled the entire edifice called America. I don't even know if the military can function anymore. We have a situation in North Korea that required military response, a military response months ago. It should have happened under Bush. But Bush was no different. He had already deballed the military. What do I mean by a military response? Let's get very clear here. Let me get down to brass tacks. I'm not saying nuclear war. We have Aegis missile cruisers off the coast of North Korea. When Kim Jong-il started toying around with his rockets, we had an opportunity to launch, with a few computer keys, a number of missiles and blow up the launch pads. That could have been done. That would have stopped all of this. But now we are at a stage where now North Korea is threatening nuclear war. And what's Obama doing? Nothing but giving speeches as though he's still in a college somewhere in Chicago. Comes to Iran, the people are being shot in the streets. The Hitler of Iran wins a fraudulent election. Why do I say fraudulent? Because nobody could have concluded that he had, that anyone had won, or what the results were, because there were 40 million handwritten ballots in Iran. Do you know that? 40 million ballots that had not been counted already. He was the winner. Sounds very much like the Democrat Party declared Obama the winner before Acorn even went out in the street with truncheons. He was already the winner. And so as I say to you, where has Obama shown any leadership? I certainly don't know it. I haven't any idea where he's showing any leadership. So it's very dangerous. Now, why am I tying in rejection and showing the people who are listening to the show that most of the people who are older, let's say over 40 listening to this show, grew up with a great deal of rejection, grew up understanding that struggle was the core of existence and the core of building a character, and now we have a whole generation that does not want to subject themselves to generation to rejection, excuse me, and does not want to do the hard work necessary to save America from this neo-Marxist juggernaut that is aimed at our jugular vein. And that's why I'm doing it. I'm telling you we're in grave danger here. While Obama is a wimp when it comes to real dictators, I think he's anything but a wimp when it comes to the internal opposition called the true conservatives. And that's a very important concept for you to grasp. Oh, he's no wimp when it comes to you and I. They're using all the power of this government, including the propaganda arms called ABC, CBS, NBC, etc., which now are part and parcel of the propaganda machine called the government media complex. They're using all of it to sway your mind and to control you. But when it comes to Iran, when it comes to North Korea, suddenly he wimps out. You understand what I'm saying to you? So that's what I'm asking you today. What did you have to do to get where you are today? Because I learned that the sale begins when the customer says no. I forget exactly in which particular job I was in when I learned that very young, but I did. What does that actually mean? It means that when you go out to sell something, expect the person you're selling it to say, no, go away, don't bother me. Well, what does that mean? Well, you want to run away and go have a drink because you feel bad? No, you got to go stay there. Be persistent. You got to be very persistent. Persistence pays off whether it's in a love affair or in business. Nobody throws themselves at you in this world. Go back to the biology. Even you want to talk boys and girls, you know, in a very nice family way. Study biology. I remember when I was when I first studied fertilization of an egg. You look at the millions of sperm that travel to reach that one ovum that is going to be the recipient of only one spermatozoan. You think about it. See, it's incredible. And you start to think about yourself. You say, well, what if another sperm had reached the egg? Would I be here? I don't know. I can't answer the question, but the answer is no. So it's a miracle that you're even here, that you as you, your DNA, for example, is a result of that particular aggressive sperm, you want to call it that, that found the one soft spot, so to speak, in the ovum and penetrated it to fertilize that egg. It's a miracle. The whole thing's a miracle from beginning to end. But there's a bigger story here. The biggest story is millions and millions and millions try to get into that area. They try to reach there. Many millions die on the way. And then only one sperm gets to penetrate that entire gigantic ovule. You say, well, what does that tell you about life? It tells you everything about life. A, that women rule. B, that you must learn to say to your wife, yes, dear, no matter what she says. C, no, I mean, not to get too philosophical here, but everyone understands that women control everything. That's what you got to understand that. And a lot of male violence comes from the fact that they won't accept the fact that they're subservient to the females. They outlive you. They inherit all the money, et cetera. So you better be smart about it. Doesn't mean after you humiliate yourself. But the fact is, you learn that very young. But you also learn that everything is about competition. Everything is about competition. And that you yourself are just one mote in the mire, so to speak. And that's the lesson here, which is that you got to struggle to achieve anything. And I don't believe that this country can remain great without struggling against oppressive regimes such as North Korea, for example, in this case, and Iran. Stuart, line one from WOR. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, Mike, in line with your comments, I'd like to volunteer to be the first white male over 50 to leave the country. But not only leave the country, but give away all of my possessions that I've worked hard for to the first illegal family that comes forward.
Well, you should, Stuart, because you've had a good number of years in America, haven't you?
It's been enough.
And in a certain way, if you think about it, you stole it from the descendants of the Aztecs. In a strange way, all those years you were working, whatever you may have been doing, you really were taking it from the Aztecs in a certain way.
I didn't deserve it in the first place.
Well, let's not be abstract. I mean, you actually extracted the gold that you hoarded from the Aztecs themselves.
That's a nice way of saying I stole it. Let's call a spade.
Well, I wouldn't be that harsh.
Extracted, found.
Now, let me ask, speaking of gold, when you are asked to leave America, do you happen to have any gold teeth?
No.
I mean, any gold fillings, perhaps?
There must be a watch I have laying around somewhere.
Well, I would think that the government should be able to ask you to contribute any gold fillings you have, because this could help balance the budget. There's no better way to make certain that the newcomers are comfortable in this country than to make certain that the whites who are being asked to leave behind all of their gold, including that in their teeth. And by the way, Stuart, I really think that you should eschew normal airline or travel of that kind, because the government said that they have a lot of rolling stock that's empty right now, and that they're going to be using this rolling stock to transport the people, because it's actually kind of invigorating for their health to be exposed to the elements.
One other thing, Mike, despite the fact that I'm a white male and therefore the lowest rung on the totem pole and at the end of the line, I'm going to give my spot away to an illegal. I don't deserve even
that. It's only fair. It's only fair that an illegal alien get your possessions. Well, whether it comes to that or not is debatable. But what is certain to come is that what we see going on in Venezuela will happen in America unless the Messiah is exposed for what he is. Do you know that it is now illegal for anyone in Venezuela to own more than one house? Did you know that?
I didn't know that.
Anybody who owns more than one house is considered a hoarder and an enemy of the state. And just as the Jews have been driven out of Venezuela, property owners have been flooding out of Venezuela. Did you know that it's also illegal to remove more than $4,000 a year from a bank in Venezuela? And that's to make certain that Father Chavez can appropriate the money for his needs for a better nation. And since our great leader and Chavez got along so greatly, what was that ghetto thing they did with the fists? What's that called, Stuart? You're from New York.
What is what? Oh,
you know,
right
when
on,
you when,
right on.
When they tap the fists, what's that called?
That's a brother to brother. White males need not bother.
I see. So it was a signal between Obama and Chavez that although they can't say it quite yet, they're blood brothers in some way?
Not even subtle. Oh, they're brothers of the first degree.
And Obama took that book of blaming America for robbing everyone in South America, not talking, of course, about the tin pot dictators nor the folks who cut hearts out and threw the hearts down the Aztec monuments. None of that was discussed. It was all because the white man grew rubber in Brazil.
Mike, I'm taking it one step further. Not only am I giving everything up and headed to Mexico, I want them to experiment on me to see if they can use me to find a cure to swine flu. I think that.
Well, you know, that's a very, very, very noble gesture of yours. You mean you would actually volunteer to live inside a pig pen?
Hey, I've always wanted to, and it sounds like...
You know, that's a nice idea, because, look, you've had a number of good years here in America, right, Stuart?
Look, it's enough. I've lived...
It's enough. You know, yeah, that's right. And the last year should be spent in medical research.
What more could I do for my fellow man? I mean,
that's right. You know, it's ask not what your country can do for you, but ask what you can do for Obama.
That's exactly what I'm trying
to. Ask not what Obama can do for you, but what you can do for Obama. Ein Volk, ein Reich, ein Obama.
Savage.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
I can pretty much tell you the reason Obama's minions are pushing this health care plan so hard is because they know his poll numbers are falling rapidly, and that is because of the overexposure. Days of beatings, shootings, and tear gas and murder by the Iranian mullahs. And finally, the American people are seeing who Obama is when it comes to foreign affairs. We see that with North Korea moving weapons on a ship in violation of even U.N. laws, and Obama's inactivity doing nothing, you know, not even authorizing the ship to board it. The fact of the matter is the man is just nothing more than a Green Party candidate at best. A peacenik, in other words, a far-left radical. You forgot what the word radical is? The man is a far-left radical, and this is how they see the world. And he's got the press covering for him. And the more we see of Obama, the more we know his honeymoon is coming to an end. The maniacal spending is even scaring the swing voter away from Obama. He is overexposed. Every day another speech. Every day another initiative. Every day fawning media. Every day, ABC, CBS, NBC, and CNN. People are getting tired of him. And the fact of the matter is, as they get tired of him, his policies are going to have a tougher time of getting passed. He knows that. And that's why he's trying to push socialized medicine as quickly as possible so that he can then jam illegal immigration appeasement down your throat. You understand that? He's got nothing to lose no matter what he does. He's young, he's energetic, and there's no Republican to oppose him. It's a frightening scenario. 1-800-449-8255. North Korea, how come there's not a word out of the media on that one? How could that be? Hawaii, Reed, you're up on the Savage Nation. Is that story playing in Hawaii, the North Korea threat?
Yeah, no, I don't hear a word. All these Obamaites out here, you know, that supported him so much, pretty silent right now. You know, Barry and the Dreamers are just sitting back.
Is that because they feel that Barry will save them from an incoming missile with his magic wand?
Now, you tell people out here about that kind of stuff. We got missiles from North Korea out in the water out there, and they look at you like you're crazy. They don't even.
Well, what do you mean? That's because the stooge newspaper, the Advertiser, isn't reporting it. Is that it?
Well, you know, I don't really pay attention too much to the Advertiser. I'm mostly on your site, Savage. There and
no, but wait, everyone in the media knows that North Korea has a ship full of weapons, and we're doing nothing. You're telling me the idiots in Hawaii don't even know this because the local media won't report it. Isn't that what you're saying?
Yeah. It's just local news takes care of local things. You know, there's roads.
Oh, no ka'oi. You're lucky you live Hawaii.
Just a Howley out here for you, supporting you, Savage. So thanks for what you do.
Thanks for listening. Oh, no ka'oi. Hawaii, no ka'oi. Oh, you're so lucky to live on H1 freeway in traffic. Oh, no ka'oi. You're so lucky to have pollution in the ocean. Oh, no ka'oi. San Antonio, JR, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Hey, Doc Savage, how are you today? Just want to get quick to the point and tell you thank you. I don't have quite the verbiage you've got and the intelligence you've got, but about a year ago, you were one of the inspirations to get me off of drugs. I was doing a pretty bad one there, and that bad one is the cocaine. And, I just want to say thanks.
Wait. First of all, I appreciate it, but I do want to spend a minute or two with you. I want to do it without sounding self-serving. How did this show help you get the will to get off drugs?
About a year ago, you had an ex-gangbanger on there that was trying to influence young men and listen to your show and things of that nature. He tried to make them listen nightly at their own free will. And at that point in time, the way that gentleman was talking, he wasn't super educated, but he understood and was there on your wavelength and just got it. And I was like,
That's interesting. Now, wait a minute. So in other words, because of that guest, you were able to get the wherewithal to start strengthening your inner being to resist drugs? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, a lot of your different views of the non-political stuff, because you can hear that on every talk show, all points of view, and listening to you not talk about politics is my favorite part of the show.
Let's go there for a minute. What age bracket are you in without giving up too much information about yourself?
I'm 33.
So what part of the non-political stuff do you find the most interesting, entertaining?
Oh, Teddy, of course. I'm a dog.
Why does this little dog, you know, Teddy, my dog, has become almost a mental mascot of millions of people. It's amazing to me. Yet people don't even know him, and they love him.
My wife and I, we've got a dog. We've got several dogs, actually, and a lot of animals at home. Some of them are rescues and things like that, and I don't know, it's just like any dog.
So you're a good man with a kind heart who went to drugs to cover up the pain of your heart and your kindness. There's no question about it.
Yeah, well, it starts off like anything. You do it just kind of goofing around, and the next thing you know, it leads to another, and it takes a hold of your life. And
just goofing around. So when I did shows on the dangers of marijuana, which I called the most dangerous of all drugs because it is a gateway drug, you would agree with that, I think, at this point in your life.
Ironically enough, I can't stand marijuana. It makes you stupid.
But did you start with marijuana or you went right into cocaine?
I went right to the hard stuff.
Oh, my God. So you're an anomaly. I really never heard of that.
Yeah, reflecting back, I really can't remember how I started. I mean, I was going through some tough times and I quit for a while and got in a bad point in my life. And I guess that was the escape to not dealing with reality. And I don't know.
What kind of program did you go into to get off drugs other than listening to the Savage Nation? I mean, this couldn't be the whole thing. Did you go into treatment?
No, friends and family. just a lot of friends and family, and I'm not a super religious guy, but, you know, you have to stare up a few times when you're looking at yourself at 5, 6 in the morning, and you're like, why aren't I sleeping? What the heck's wrong with me? Why am I being so stupid? You know better, but you just can't do it. It just takes a hold of your life, and, you know, just listen to you and be quite honest with you, going to the drug dealer's house, listen to your show, going, why am I going, and I'm listening to this guy tell me how stupid I am. You know, and still did it anyway.
Well, let me tell you something. If I can do this show every day, day in and day out at my age after 15 years without drugs, you can certainly live your life without drugs. Trust me, there are days that I wish to God I could reach for something to make it all go away. But you can't. You can't make life go away. Why do you think on a gravestone the RIP is there, rest in peace? Why do you think it's always been called rest in peace? Because none of us are in peace in our life. It's the one thing to remember is that you're not alone in your turmoil, your anxiety, your anguish. All human beings by nature are filled with turmoil, anxiety, and anguish. It's a lie. It's a lie put out by Hollywood and the media that some are, you know, some people don't feel that. Well, maybe some don't. Most people do. That's called life. And I think that once you accept that life is not a bed of roses, has been put that way, and that you have to face the fact that it's terribly difficult from morning till night, just facing life itself is not easy. You're not going to need drugs.
Quick comment, Mr. Savage. I did make a small donation today to your legal defense fund.
No, you don't have to do that. I'd rather you didn't, Jay. I really thank you, but you don't have to. I thank you. You know what I want to do for you right now, JR, is send you a copy of Psychological Nudity, because I think you will enjoy reading the stories in there, and I think that that's going to help you a great deal.
I actually read a couple of chapters from a friend of mine's book, and I was hooked, and he's like, no, I can't let you borrow it. I'm not done with it yet.
No. You stay on the line. It's going to be sent out to you immediately. Thanks for calling. Beautiful call. You know, last night I was watching cage fighting, you know, mixed martial arts, and I enjoy watching it up to a point. Then I have to turn it off at a certain point. There's something about watching a very powerful man getting pummeled on the ground that bothers me. I don't mind these guys bashing each other because they like it. These guys are so tough. They're not like you and I. Any one of their head strikes would kill one of us. I don't know what these guys are made of. I just don't understand it. But the longer I have lived, the more I come to understand all human beings are not the same in any sphere. Some are good at this, some are good at that, and there are some guys who are built for fighting. Just as, and I'm not making any derogatory comparison, there are certain breeds of dogs that are bred for fighting. Is that correct? My poodle isn't bred for fighting. I mean, you get killed with one bite. We do have to go to the pit bull or the mastiff. You understand that they're bred to fight. And so, therefore, there are people who can take this kind of punishment. And although, you know, you watch a fight like this and you see one of the guys on the ground with the other guy on top of him, and he's doing the ground and pound and beating him. Wow! I mean, like a watermelon being punched. Over and over, I'm amazed at how quick the referees can jump in and stop it, because when guys are in a fight and their adrenaline is rushing, they will kill the other man and not even know they've killed the other man unless they're stopped. They're not fighting with any sense of hold of control. They're fighting to kill the other guy. And so the referees in these mixed martial arts fights are amazingly adept, and I've never seen anyone get killed in mixed martial arts, incidentally. The point I'm getting at is I watch these guys, and I see the strength of the human being, and I'm impressed each and every time at the actual physical capacity of the human being. And it goes back to what I used to notice when I was a kid growing up. You know, I'd read the newspapers, the Daily News, the Daily Mirror, the Post. I liked all of the picture newspapers because they told the whole story with one picture. So inevitably, every once in a while, every couple of months, there'd be a story about a kid fell out of a third story or a second story window and then hit an awning and bounced and landed on the ground, and he was just had bruises. And then they would show the window and then the arrows, dot, 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 bounced here and he landed there, and then they'd show the kid. And I'd say to myself, how could a kid survive falling out of a second or third story window? Answer, because the human being is much stronger than we are led to believe. Now, this goes right to Obamacare. The government wants you to think that you're weak. Governments want you to be helpless. Governments want you to need them. Government wants you to come to them for medication. Government wants you to think that every quirk, every ache, every pain, every fear, needs to be treated by government medicine and medication. And what I'm telling you is rubbish, bah, humbug. You know, you never heard of self-reliance? That's what I'm talking about. We are all much tougher than we are led to believe we are. I learned this from really from my mother more than from anybody else. She lived to 88. She had plenty of problems in her life. Emotional things happened to her that I don't want to go into. Somehow she learned how to sort through them. And she used to say to me, every time I try to complain to her about something, she said, "What, do you think I don't have pains?" And she embarrassed me in a way. She didn't do it in a way to make me feel bad. If I come and say my head hurts, because I always suffered migraines as a kid till I learned how to get rid of them at age 18 by reading George Osawa's Zen Macrobiotics and studying diet. That's when I first started on the road to my own self-treatment. The point I'm making is that she said to me, "Don't you think I have aches and pains?" She never took an aspirin. So she taught me that it's embarrassing for a man to walk around complaining about anything, you know, with human frailties. And yet you turn on the TV and what do you see? Inevitably, it's a white male, a weakling, running to his mother-wife figure saying, "Mommy, get me an aspirin. Mommy, get me a drug." Every other ad is for some other problem that you need a drug for. I have never seen such a conspiracy in my life. I'll be right back. I think I'm going to work on the next installment of Psychological Nudity. I'm working on a lot of things again. I come out of my doldrums. I had a two-month job, 2 months of doldrums. Wow. I found out what I've known all along, though, about my own mind. I am riboflavin and or thiamine dependent. My psyche is riboflavin and thiamine dependent. Many of you don't even know what I'm talking about. Because many of you take vitamins and you know it boosts your mood. Particularly if you've been doing it with the proper supplements for long enough, as I have. I don't think you understand how important B2 and B1 are. Many of you know about B3 and niacin. You probably know nothing about riboflavin and thiamine. I'm somewhat of a minor expert on these particular B vitamins with regard to mood stimulation, but I don't want to go into it right now. I tell you, when I miss a few days of B2 and B1, I have a sense of doom. I have a sense that, you know, nothing's right. I have a sense that, you know, doom is around the corner, all things are bad. And then when I get the right B2, B1 levels, I can feel it almost within minutes. My vision improves and my mood improves. And you won't hear that from your local doctor, by the way, because they're going to put you on Prozac, Lipitor, Prilosec, the one for the down below. What's that one called? Viagra. Do you know how many different drugs the average man over 50 is on? Do you have any idea how many drugs you don't need they put you on? Today came out what I've been telling you for 20 years now, that acetaminophen is a kidney killer and a liver killer. And the reason I knew that is because there was so many people with liver damage in this country. And I try to figure out over 20 years why all of a sudden was there such a cluster of a demand for liver transplants. And then I turn the TV on and they're telling normal healthy athletes, men and women, to take 6-8 Tylenol a day. They made it look like it was a vitamin for you, when I knew at least 15 years ago in graduate school that acetaminophen was a very dangerous drug with regard to your kidneys and your liver. I used it extremely sparingly, if at all. I prefer aspirin, by the way, for any kind of pain. For me, aspirin's a minor miracle drug, and it has a safety record, bar none, in all the painkiller category, incidentally. But what I'm getting at is, in addition to the Tylenol and Tylenol-related acetaminophen drugs, you are on 6 to 8 prescription drugs. Like, if I rarely go to a doctor for something, which happens from time to time, the first thing they say to me is, "What medications are you on?" And I say, "None." The nurse looks up at me. "None," she says? "A man your age on no drugs?" I said, "No, no drugs." "How is that possible?" "Because I have a degree in nutrition, a PhD. I'm a practitioner of what I preach. I've written books on the subject. I don't need them. Thank you very much. Not yet. I may. Tomorrow I may need them." Okay? Can't you kick the drug habit? Because it's not only good for your health, it's good for society. One of the reasons we're going broke is because you've been turned into a drug-addicted victim of the medical pharmaceutical establishment, in my opinion. Whatever. this wonderful, incredible nation called America, I should turn over to skunks in business suits and women in dirty dresses? We got to try to save America from the enemies external and the corruption within. That's what motivates me. I want to leave my children something. I was born into a Garden of Eden. I don't want to leave them a hellhole. So every day, if you look at the world and you look at the landscape and you look at what's going on, ask yourself who's making the world a hell and who is making the world into a heaven.
Savage.
The world is watching what's going on in Iran, and the president gives a speech that is pure sophistry, saying that we shouldn't meddle because if we do, they'll turn it against us and blah, blah, blah. I don't buy it for a minute because with regard to China, Hillary Clinton goes there, if you remember 2 weeks ago. She makes no statements about human rights and democracy. With regard to Darfur, this administration, after much sound and fury during the campaign, does nothing. I don't think that this administration is as sharp as they pretend to be, number one. And I'm not going to take the approach that they're evil and they want this to go on. I think that they're a bunch of academics who are trying themselves out as they go along. But let's focus on Iran. Many of us say, well, we're on the side of the kids because we know Ahmadinejad is a psychopathic Hitler, the psychopathic Hitler of our time. But the real question is, what happens if the protesters do win? And the other side actually gets the recount and they do win, which I think is not going to happen, by the way. How does that affect us? How does it affect the Iranian people? Is there a real difference? I don't know, but we have an expert who may be able to help us. Dr. Carafano is at the Heritage Foundation. Dr. Carafano teaches at West Point. He's a graduate of West Point. He served 25 years in the Army. He retired as a lieutenant colonel. He served in Europe, Korea, and the U.S. He knows what he's talking about. Let's listen to what he has to say. Dr. Carafano, thank you for being with us on the Savage Nation.
Good to be with you.
So, doctor, the other fellow in Iran, does he represent true reform, or is it a different face of the mullahs?
It's a different face. I mean, this guy came out of the revolutionary tradition. It, you know, it's like the difference between Stalin and Khrushchev. He's more pragmatic. You know, he may not, you know, cheer, you know, people being stoned in the street for holding hands, but, you know, at the end of the day, he's not interested in, you know, creating a democracy or overturning the supreme leader or even stopping Iran's nuclear program.
Where does the other, what is the other guy's name, by the way? I don't even know. I'm going to be honest with you. I can't remember it.
Yeah, it's Mousavi.
Okay, fine. Now I know that. I can act like I'm smart, like people on NBC, and repeat his name perfectly. Where does he stand with regard to the great Satan and the little Satan?
Well, he would actually like to have a friendlier face to the West. I mean, he campaigned strongly on that Ahmadinejad had alienated the West from Iran, made a lot of enemies, that part of the reason why the economy was doing so poorly was because of the economic sanctions that were being imposed. And this resonated with a lot of Iranians. A lot of Iranians are actually very pro-Western. They're actually very well-read, well-educated. It's demographically, compared to a lot of countries in Western Europe, it's a younger country. But, you know, Iranians have two lives. You know, there's the public life, and then there's the private sphere. And in Iran, you know, what goes on behind the closed doors in your old household, that's your own business. And when you go into Iranian homes, actually many Iranians are very Western in their tastes and things. And so his message of, you know, we need to quit antagonizing the West and like Ahmadinejad threatening, you know, to melt countries down, denying the Holocaust, that's not getting us anywhere. And that message is resonating strongly with Iran. But we shouldn't.
Why does Ahmadinejad have such a hatred for Israel and the United States? I have had Iranians tell me that he's not even Persian, that he's not even of Persian origin. Can you speak to that?
Well, you know, you kind of have the David and Goliath complex here. Here's a kid, you know, that came, you know, from a very low, you know, economic strata, you know, was put down all his life, isn't terribly well educated, and, you know, and he really has a chip on his shoulder. And, you know, you raised the analogy with Hitler, but, you know, if you look at Hitler's life, you know, it's, you know, this little squirmy kid that gets drunk with power and really is, you know, taking revenge for, you know, not being, you know, loved and respected. I mean, this...
Are you not talking about Obama, are you?
Well, you know, Ahmadinejad is almost in a class by his own and world leaders as being aggressive and really self, you know, destructive. You know, what people don't realize is Ahmadinejad is a great enemy. He's a great enemy of the Iranian people. He's done more to destroy the economy of Iran than anybody. I mean, basically, he's doing like Chavez in Venezuela. He's taking the oil money and he's using it to basically run the country. They're, you know, driving the economy into the gutter. He's redistributing wealth. And if it wasn't for the oil money, that, you know, that country would be a basket case.
All right, I understand all of that. So the other fellow is a slight improvement from the point of view of America's national security issues. Let's be pragmatic, Doctor. If the other guy wins, do we breathe easier about a nuclear war?
No. Because
no, we don't. In other words, he's still on a war path with the mullahs taking over the world and exporting radical Islam, the same thing, Hezbollah and Hamas?
Because he's the president, it doesn't mean he runs the country. Matter of fact, you know, obviously, you know, the supreme leader, who is kind of the religious guy, he, at the end of the day, is supposed to get the final say. But even underneath him, you know, there are three different armies in Iran. There are intelligence groups. I mean, there are all kinds of people pulling different strings. The president of Iraq doesn't run everything. So if a new guy got elected president and he said tomorrow, you know what, I'm canceling the nuclear weapons research program, that doesn't mean it would happen.
All right. So at the end of the day, it doesn't matter to Americans who wins.
Well, we're, you know, we are slightly better off, and the Iranians are slightly better off with a less regime. But here's what's going to happen, which is you're not going to get this guy. They're going to go out on the streets, and they're going to really crack down on the protesters, and they're going to stop.
So we're going to see another Tiananmen Square. We've already seen, what, 18, 20, 100 dead? And so we've had a Tiananmen Square already, and they're going to get worse, right?
And the guys that are really going to have the power are going to be the extremists. They're going to say, see what happens when you give people a little freedom? And so the likelihood is we're going to have a government that is less friendly, less willing to negotiate. And here's what really, you know, gripes me, is here's the Obama administration trying to preserve, well, we have to be able to dialogue with these people. Well, you know what? When this is said and done, those people are going to want to talk to you less, not more. So you're preserving the ability to talk to somebody that doesn't care what you think and isn't going to do anything different.
All right, Dr. Carafano, I see in your excellent resume that you have spent time in the military in Korea. I am not a military man, but I understand history. We have Kim Jong-il floating around nuclear weapons. We have the sad story of the United States Navy trailing the ship with an engagement policy that is allowed to go only so far as hail and query, which I've never heard of before until Obama came along. What's happened to the U.S. Navy that it can't board that ship and sink it if necessary to protect our national security?
Yeah, what it was, you know, this is another case. I mean, I think you have it exactly right. You know, this administration looks great when they can stage something, you know, a trip to Europe, and they can, you know, everything's kind of set piece, and they can frame it so Obama's strengths really come out. But when it comes to moments of decision making and crisis, they look really weak and ineffectual. So here they make a declaration: well, we're going to search these ships. But then comes the other thing, if they let us. Well, that's a stupid policy to announce because, A, they're not going to let you, and, B, the hardest thing to do is to try to search a ship at sea. If they were really serious about interdicting stuff, what they would have done is trail the ship, let it get to the port of a country where we could deal with, and then they jump on it so the guy they'd be caught by surprise, and they do something for real. But, no, what they want to do is sound tough, knowing that they couldn't and weren't going to be tough. So they look like idiots.
Now, you went to the rank of lieutenant colonel during your service, 25 years in the Army. When did this policy change with regard to the Navy to this level of non-interventionism? Did this change under Bush?
No, I mean, it depends on what you're doing. I mean, if you want to stop and search ships, I mean, that's the equivalent of an act of belligerence, right? So, you know, you can do that if you want, but that's a whole different kettle of fish. But, you know, what Bush did was very, very smart under what's called the Proliferation Security Initiative, was something they set up, and which actually something Obama has continued, and I don't know why he just doesn't do that, which is you don't telegraph your moves to the other guy. You know, if you want to search a ship, then you set it up so the guy doesn't have any alternative, but you let you search a ship, or he can't move, or you can sink the ship. What you don't do is what they're doing now. There are other ways they could have dealt with this without changing laws or declaring war in North Korea, but they chose not to do that because they wanted to look tough, and instead they look stupid.
Last question of the day, Darfur. Obama sends General Scott Gratian to Sudan. not to Sudan, and nothing is done. Why is it that the liberals who spoke so passionately about Darfur and the slaughter in Darfur are doing nothing now that they have the power?
Well, they're actually sitting around kind of staring at their hands, worrying, thinking, what are we going to do here? Because actually, if you looked at some of the on Iran, I mean, you know, people on the left have been as stunned as people on the right why the president couldn't just speak out in favor of the people of Iran. So
yes,
I think they're sitting there going, they don't, because what are they going to do? Go back and embrace the policies of Bush? No. So they're trying to pretend like this is the president.
In other words, they're showing that they're not interventionists, so therefore they become isolationist, which is very interesting to me because isolationism is actually an old conservative policy, is it not?
Yeah, I tell you, the one that really gripes me is some people try to you know put lipstick on the pig, and they said, look at what the people of Lebanon done, because there was just recently an election in Lebanon where the moderates won, and they
yes.
said, look what happened in Lebanon, and look at the people rising up in Iran. This is all because of Obama's public diplomacy and his speeches. He's rallying the people. That's ridiculous. I mean, that's unbelievably absurd. First of all, you talk about they want to have a more humble foreign policy, and so apparently people can't grasp for freedom unless Obama makes a speech. Well, that's nuts. And the notion that somehow because he made this speech is causing the protest, I mean, that is just strange credulity. I think even when they say it, John Kerry said this. Even when they say it, I think they're really grasping for straws. And here's what we've discovered. I mean, this is not me. I'm nonpartisan. I'm not Republican. I'm not a Democrat. I don't even belong to a political party. This is just what we know. Okay, when Obama can stage manage his interaction on the foreign policy stage, he looks very presidential and very decisive. When events jump upon him, he looks indecisive and weak, period.
Well, I agree with you, Dr. Carafano, but the take-home message, if I were to discuss this evening with someone over a beer, is that it really doesn't matter to us who wins in Iran, but Obama looks weak because he said nothing?
I think it doesn't matter who won in Iran. Ahmadinejad's going to be the president. He's going to be an enemy of America. And Obama has done nothing to advance protecting this country against him. And let's not forget that this is a president that just cut $1.4 billion, 15% of the missile defense budget, while Iran has a regime that's going to be more radical than ever, and while their missile programs and their nuclear programs are moving.
Wait a minute. Isn't it the liberals who didn't want to fund Star Wars and were against missile defenses? And as I pointed out on the show Friday, it's the missile defense system that's been floated into Hawaii that might protect the citizens from a North Korean launch. How come the liberals in Hawaii don't say, take it away, we don't need it, turn it into basketball courts?
Well, the last time the North Koreans did a missile launch back in April, Obama said, don't send the radar to sea, don't put the missile defenses on alert. And by the way, I don't like missile defense because it's not cost-effective and it's not proven. And now all of a sudden, a couple of months later, he's a big fan of missile defense. And Secretary Gates is running around going, oh, we got our defenses are on watch and we got the radar up and we're all set to go. And then they turn around and they cut 15% from the budget, which is going to kill that program. The missile defenses that are going to protect us today, these guys are going to eliminate that program. It won't exist 5 years from now.
Do you think that the North Koreans are going to launch that rocket?
I think they'll launch a rocket. It's not going to have a warhead on it, which means even if it hits something, it wouldn't do a lot of damage.
It's saber rattling to show that they're players. But last question, Dr. Carafano, is this. Don't you believe, as I do, that North Korea is simply the junkyard dog of China?
Well, I'll tell you, I think this is a bigger problem. People look at the threat of missiles from North Korea, and they look at the threat of missiles from Iran, and the truth is that's one missile program, and they are working on it together, and that someday they're both going to have a nuclear weapon and a missile, and someday they're going to say, you mess with Iran, then you're messing with North Korea, and vice versa. So, when Bush talked about the
axis of evil, he was 100% right. There is an axis of evil. I don't know what's so hard to figure out. There are nations where there's a relative democracy and freedom, and then there are nations which are absolutely totalitarian dictatorships. How hard is it to figure out?
Yeah, you go and you look at an Iranian missile, that successfully test-fired. And then you look at the next North Korean test, and you know what? It looks a lot more like the Iranian missile. And then if the North Korean missile works, you go back and look at the Iranian program. And so they are learning from each other. They're sharing technology. They're working together. It's one enemy. And
you know what I hope you can stay over the break, I'll tell you. I thought this would be a five-minute interview, but it's rare that I have someone who knows what he's talking about to this extent. Doctor, when we come back, I'd like to ask you if you think Israel will act, and everyone says, well, they have to now, but will they act is the question, or will we see a nuclear missile launched against Israel with the annihilation of the Jewish state? Right here on the Savage Nation, I'll be right back. The world is really in a very dangerous place. We have Iran and North Korea right now center stage. Obama is taking a hands-off approach with regard to Iran, and he's saying that's a mark of strength. Well, most Americans see it as a mark of weakness. That's why his poll numbers are collapsing. Then we have North Korea, where, again, Obama is doing nothing, telling a Navy ship to just trail the North Korean ship and use a hail and query policy, and doing nothing. And now we have a question to present our expert, Dr. James Carafano, Ph.D. Dr. Carafano, again, welcome back to the Savage Nation. The issue is now one of Iran. Whoever wins, they're going to pursue the same anti-American, anti-European, pro-radical Islamic policies, basically, is what you're saying. What about Israel? They've claimed for years now that they have an existential threat to their existence. Do you think Israel will act unilaterally?
Well, I can tell you this. Talking to people familiar with what's going on over there, there was certainly a big debate within the Israeli government, even with Netanyahu in charge, about what their next step was and what they would do. I would say with this government in charge, and not just Ahmadinejad being reelected, but with the hardliners really gaining an upper hand in the country, I think the odds of an Israeli attack actually go up.
Go up. But does Israel have a choice but to act?
Well, you know, here's the challenge for them. You know, they don't have, in terms of, they can certainly get airplanes over there. Of course, the Iranians are building up their missile defenses. So the longer the Israeli wait, the harder it'll be. But, you know, they don't have bombs that can, you know, deeply penetrate into these, bunkers and things. So they can't take out everything. They don't have some of the intelligence that the U.S. can provide. So they could do a strike. They could probably do a strike. They could do some damage. They can put the program back. They'd probably get some grief, you know, in the Middle East, although most people quietly would be applauding and cheering that they put the Iranian program back a bit. They might get, you know, some one-off attacks from Hezbollah or Hamas, although they've been pretty crippled. So they could do it. They could get away with it. It would probably have a pretty good effect. And, you know, right now, you know, we used to say, no, don't do that, Israel, because if you do that, it's just going to rally the Iranian people behind Ahmadinejad. The truth is, if the Israelis did it now, there are people in Iran that would probably applaud.
Yeah, I was saying, if Israel's going to act, they should act during this turmoil. It would, in my opinion, weaken Ahmadinejad, the Ahmadinejad faction and the Mullah faction. I don't think it would strengthen them, or would it? Or would it have the opposite effect?
Well, if it had been done before the elections, or even right after the elections, you know, it would have been a rallying cry, oh, we have to defend ourselves against Israel. But if the Israelis wait for the dust to settle, which I totally think they were doing, they wanted to see, you know, what's going to happen with this election and how things are going to pan out. But the truth is, you know, in a couple of weeks, you know, I think, the die will, you know, could well be cast. And
I'm sorry, you raised another issue before. I only have a minute in the rest of this hour, that Israel doesn't have the bunker-busting bombs. You're saying they could get them from the U.S. if they had an ally in Obama. Isn't that what you're implying?
They've asked for them in the United States, and Obama said no. So what they have is bombs that can't go very deep. They also have cruise missiles, but cruise missiles have very small warheads. They also can't go very deep. So if they wanted bunker-busting bombs, they'd have to get them from us.
But why does Obama not provide them with bunker-busting bombs to take out the Iranian nuclear threat once and for all?
You kind of scratch your head, because if the Israelis are going to do this, wouldn't you want them to do it right? And what are you going to say? Oh, well, everybody will know. If we give them the bombs, everybody is going to know they came from us and we were complicit. But you know what? When Israel strikes Iran, guess what the Iranians are going to say? The U.S. is behind it. So what difference does it make? You know, it's just like Obama saying, well, we don't want to interfere with
Iran. Are we going to wait for Hitler to invade Poland Czechoslovakia and the Soviet Union before we wake up to what's going on? You know what I'm saying? I mean, you're the military historian. Dr. James Carafano, Ph.D., thank you so much for enlightening the Savage Nation.
Savage.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
Because, first of all, I'd like to be there right now, truthfully. But I'm going to wait it out. Great place. It's a great place. Great. I lived there for a number of years, you know. You know what it's like for a kid from New York to go, like, to wind up in Hawaii? I'd never been in a place like that. It was unbelievable. It was like walking into, a heaven itself. So anyway, to make a long story short, we're talking about a turn it off now, a long time ago. You know, when you land in heaven, you think you can do anything, and you have hubris. Hubris is a sense of confidence that only children and the mad have and can understand. But when a grown-up has hubris, it becomes very dangerous, and in my case, that was true. So you get to the islands, and it's a magical time. You never saw sunsets like this. They can break your heart. When you see plumeria blossoms lying on the, you know, I used to bicycle up to the university. I would see plumeria blossoms lying on the sidewalk. I would stop the bicycle and pick up the plumeria blossoms and look at them and smell them. And I'd never seen anything like this. Sure, I had seen rose petals on the fence in the Bronx when I was a little kid. They were soft and beautiful. But this was something unique. The scent was unlike anything I had ever experienced. And so you see these sunsets and these sunrises and all of these things that you had never seen, and birds in the jungles in the back of the rainforest that you never saw or heard before. And you start to get tuned into your own body in a way you've never been tuned in. If you've never lived in the tropics and it's the first time, and you start shedding clothing and shoes and leather and you put it all away, and now you're in flip-flops and then you're in shorts, and all of a sudden at night the breeze comes through your sleeves and you start to become alive in a new way, and you go in the warm water. So you start to feel like the original man. And you buy a sailboat. It's the first thing you do. And so I bought a sloop-rigged boat. She was not catch-rigged. I was mistaken. I remember now. Tirangi was a sloop-rigged sailing vessel, about 22 feet long. And it was made of white oak, primarily. And it had been built in Oregon and sailed out by somebody else to Hawaii. I bought it for nothing, you know, next to nothing. She was in perfect shape and no engine, as I said. So I buy this boat. I put it into the Alawai Yacht Harbor. And that's where I kept it. And, you know, most people who own boats mainly use them to drink on and hang out. And it's as good a thing to do as any. But I was foolish enough to actually want to sail the boat, even though I knew nothing about sailing. And I took it out without an engine. I knew it was pretty easy to get out because the wind was prevailing out of the yacht harbor. And I said, wow, this is great. And so I, you know, with a few friends, I was on a boat alone. They just cast me off, released the lines, pushed me backwards. And there we go, down the Alawai Channel, out into the channel, and out into the ocean. I was zipping along with the sail out, and I was zipping along out onto sea, and there I was. I said, this is super. I'm really enjoying myself. Then I realized I didn't know how to get back. I said, how do I turn this thing around if the wind is blowing out? Well, I didn't know how. And I said, well, I better figure this out, because if this keeps up for a while, I'll soon be out in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, and there'll be no way back at all. I had no flares, no radio, no engine, all I had was confidence that was bordering on the insane. So the first thing I did was I resorted to common sense and I dropped the sails because that, of course, would cut the motion of the boat. I dropped the sails and using the tiller, I turned the boat around, you know, flip flop, until I got the boat pointing back towards the land. And then I figured if the wind is blowing against me, there must be a way to go into a prevailing wind and still move against it. I've seen other people do it. And little by little and lo and behold, I was able to, luckily, I don't know whether it was current or God's hand itself pushed me back into the harbor, but I learned quickly that sailing is not for the amateur. That's all there was to it. So those days are over. But she was my first boat. I don't have a life ring from Tarangi because I didn't even have a life ring. I don't even think I had a life preserver. You know, those were the age. That was an age when people had total, like, madness about what they could do and accomplish in the late 60s. But now I drive a power boat, and it has all sorts of safety equipment on it. Sure, not enough that I should have. But I like power boats a lot better because they're easier to get out. I can get this thing on the way. It's 45 feet, twin diesels, 19 tons, unladen with fuel and water, and I can go out on it alone and come back on it alone in almost any wind. And that's the good part. You can get out in 12, 15 minutes, and there it is. It's just you and the birds and the water and the land, and that's it. And that's what I go out for now, is just to look at the water and look at the birds and look at the landforms, mainly, and the seals I like. And I can name every bird on the bay. More or less, I know every bird on the bay as a species. Not by name, not like, how you doing, howdy. I don't mean that. Species-wise, I've come to understand that every animal has a personality. Isn't this strange? It's not that the PETA folks are correct. I still eat animals. But they all have a personality when you get to know them. And they all want to live. Dad taught me that everything wants to live. That's how he taught me to respect human life. He said, you'll notice that a cat wants to live, a dog wants to live, a rat wants to live, a mouse wants to live, a bird wants to live. And he had learned that when he had accidentally shot a bird. As a kid, remember, this is odd to a country boy listening to the show. It sounds very weak. But remember, I'm a New York City boy. And to us, it's a different experience than it is to you guys. I respect your ability to hunt for your food. But every animal actually has a personality when you get to know that animal. They're all different. Just as we're all different, every human is unique and like a snowflake. Well, guess what? So are animals. They're all unique. It's amazing when you come to understand that. Someone once said this to me, a professor back in 1970. He said, you know, you're the only person I've ever met. He said, it's astonishing that you can function. He says, you have no barrier between your conscious and your subconscious. You actually function with both at once. So I said, and? So? What's wrong with that? In other words, I plumb my depth sufficiently through self-analysis to know who I am, and I'm not ashamed of it. What do I got to hide? I'm not like most people. I mean, well, what's there to hide? When everything I see isn't so pretty. But that's life, you know. Out of the muck, a lotus will grow. We all come from the muck, and we all go back to the muck. We come from the muck. We go back to the muck. What more do you need to know? None of us are demigods. None of us are God. Once you understand that we arise from a smelly ether called the swamp of life, and that is what we go back to, the rest is very easy. Then you stop worrying about if you have an extra little flab on your stomach and a gray hair and a mole on your face. And you suddenly accept yourself for what you are. Then you can wear an undershirt and look at yourself in the mirror and say, that's it, thank God I'm alive. And I got two legs and two arms and two lungs and a beating heart. What more do I need? I'm going to look like a bicycle rider who takes cocaine? Oh, God, what am I talking about? Why are you listening to me? I'm going up and down the scale here. I'm playing the scales for you on the Savage Nation. No, I'm a little upset because I opened a letter just now, a personal letter. I shouldn't have done it during the show. I got all my mail, and I opened one from a relative. It's a shocker. It's a picture of my late father from a year before he died. Photo of Daddy enclosed. Your mother kept it in her bag till she did. No, I never saw this picture. He looked healthy. He shouldn't have died this young. I'm older than he was, and he died. It's eerie. Yeah, I thank God Oscar the cat is in here. He's liable to curl up next to me, and it will be all be all over. He was in better shape than I am. Are you kidding me? And he died anyway? Not a gray hair on his head. And thin? I put on weight. I got gray hair, and I'm still kicking. Go figure it out. You know how many guys died in their 30s that I knew who were runners? Huffing and puffing with watches, and they'd vitamin every minute. They looked at their watch. They wouldn't touch this, and they ate perfect. They dropped dead like flies. I don't say don't exercise, but no man is made to run like an Ethiopian bee picker day and night. You're not living in Ethiopia at 12,000 feet. That's why they win these races everywhere. That's they run at high altitudes. You don't. Every year is a few blowouts here with the San Francisco, what do they call it? Marathon, the marathon. Every year they got someone dropping dead before the finish line. If you want to run, go run. Enjoy yourself. This too shall pass. I have a whole different theory of exercise at a certain point in your life. Now, remember, I wrote the book on nutrition, and I also exercise moderately, but the key word is moderately. This excessive, like you're on a treadmill, heart attackville. It's worse than sitting in front of a television and eating Doritos. And I'm telling you, no human being is made to... You ever see old men running like that? It's insanity, total insanity. Show me in nature where a man runs like that after the age of 40, unless he's being chased by a predator who wants to burn his house down. Nobody runs like that if they don't have to. What did the great American writer say? Mark Twain, he said, I get all my exercise going to the funerals of my more athletic friends. It was funny. It worked for him. It worked. I'm sure if he ran, he would have been dead at 30. I'll never forget when I stopped running the day. Are you interested in any of this? I'm in a sweat from the whole story already. I ate nuts during the break. I got this picture. Now I'm having palpitations. I think I'll have a pizza for dinner tonight and beer. Nah, I think tonight I'm going to drive into the city. I'm not in the city. I'm not in San Francisco now. I'm out in the suburban location, one of my Arafatian houses. I have many locations. I don't know where I'm going to be the next night. That way, if anyone, they don't know where I'm going to, because I don't know where I'm going to broadcast from or where I'm going to sleep. I have several locations. I have to. That's what the liberals are today. I have to watch out for them because they're all psychopaths. Every last one of them belongs in a mental hospital. Or in a straitjacket. That's all. Look how they treat. Forget it. I don't want to go into bashing liberals. It's been done too often, and I did it better than anybody else. Oh, let's move on. Now you see, I'm what do you call it when you talk and talk and he looked good. Look at this. I can't get it out of my head. I shouldn't have looked at these pictures. He was, God bless him. A lot of good it did him. The wife, black hair, thin, kept in shape, and dead. And what about Winston Churchill? He sat in the bathtub drinking brandy and smoking cigars. It hurt him? Could you picture him running around, let's say, England during World War II, saying, I got to do a stress break now? Our president, all our NBA-like leaders, they all run, they're in perfect shape, and they can't think. He sat with a brandy and a cigar in a bathtub. He was able to lead Britain through the darkest days of World War II. How is that? How's that possible? Stop with the sobriety, have a drink, and sit in a bathtub with a cigar. Maybe you can save the country. You'll have some insights, like take the handcuffs off the men, number one, and tell the liberals to go to hell, number two. That might save America. KNEW, San Fran. What? Someone from England sent me a new one. I use San Francisco, San Francisco. San Fran. She called us something else, a friend from somewhere, a long email. San Fran. I can't remember why I bring it up. I'll be right back. Austin, Texas, Brandon is going to defend hippie values. Brandon, you have a big job ahead of you. Go ahead, please.
Yes, Michael. I want to know what is wrong with the hippie values of love and just acceptance of different people.
No, well, go and defend hippie values because hippie values are not love.
Well, I consider myself actually a hippie of today. I'm young. I actually do dress the fashion of hippies. Me and my friends, we're about love, about acceptance, about everything like that. And I want to know what's
Tell me what you mean by love and acceptance. What does that mean?
Well, it means you don't discriminate against people because they're gender, race.
You certainly wouldn't argue that the rampant drug use that we see in America today, including that amongst the young, is something that's positive, would you?
What do you mean?
Sorry, say that again?
Yes, say that again.
No, I'm not going to say it again. If you can't follow a thought, why are you calling a show to have a discussion?
I was going to say, I mean, I don't go around having sex with everybody. I don't do drugs. I'm just, the values, the core concepts is what
Well, let's go again. I'll start again, and please listen this time, or else I'm going to get frustrated. We won't go anywhere. You're not going to argue that the rampant drug use we see in America today, which is a hippie value, is a good value, are you?
No, I'm not, but I think marijuana...
Well, hold on. Let's take it a step at a time. You're saying there's nothing wrong with hippie values. I'm telling you what the hippie values really are. One, the legalization of all drugs. So you're saying you disagree with that?
Marijuana only. It's natural.
It's natural. Then why do you think we are seeing articles coming out of the medical establishment saying that if we don't get tough on marijuana, more people are going to wind up in mental hospitals or die?
Well, also, alcohol does the same thing as marijuana.
No, don't change the argument. We know about the dangers of alcohol. But most of us think that marijuana is a benign drug when it's the exact opposite.
I mean,
why do you assume marijuana is helpful? Why do you make that assumption?
Well, it grows from the earth. It's from the earth. It's a natural.
I know that you're a put on. You know, this is a fake voice by somebody trying to get my goat. We know that arsenic is also natural, isn't it?
I really don't know. I mean,
well, you don't. What do you know? You're like a dummy. You don't know nothing. What do you think? Because it's natural, it's good. I can show you 10 mushrooms that can kill you if you ingest 1 milligram of it. What do you mean natural? What kind of stupidity is that? There are aflatoxins that are natural, the microgram amounts would kill you. Well, where does the idea that if it's natural, it's good come from? Heroin is natural. Is that good too, Brandon?
No, heroin is not good. Heroin is not.
Oh, wait a minute. Heroin is natural. It grows from a poppy. What are you talking about? You just contradicted yourself.
Well, I'm saying marijuana, from my experience, has done less harm than heroin and all that other kind of stuff.
Well, look what it's done to you. Look what it's done to you. You can't even follow a thought for 3 seconds in a row. Here's the chief executive of the charity Sane in England. It says at least a third of murders committed by addicts of cannabis were preventable. There are murders, an epidemic of murder in England related to marijuana. Thousands of cannabis plants are being shut in England because they recognize, unlike the morons in this country, that marijuana is the most dangerous of all drugs. Look what it's done to you. It's gutted out your character. You don't even know what you're talking about. You have no idea that you have no character. What else do you think is good about hippie values then? We just agreed that drugs are not good. Well, give me another hippie value that is good. Random and free sex with a stranger is good?
No, I've never done that. I've never had sex with a stranger.
All right, I'm talking hetero. I'm talking homo. I'm talking about random sex with strangers on a regular basis. You wouldn't argue that that's a good thing for society, I don't think.
You should. Oh, no, that's one good thing. That's one bad thing, I have had...
But Brandon, there's another hippie value. So we got two hippie values now. Random sex with strangers and rampant drug use. Both are hippie values. All right, Brandon, thanks for trying. You're not a bad person. I just wish to God that your mental health was tuned up a little better.
Savage.
Ryan, welcome to the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Dr. Savage. I was wondering why I haven't heard you really rant more about technology, in particular cell phones and MySpace and Facebook and these other...
Well, first of all, I don't rant. I do expostulations and such, but there are others in the business who might rant on it. What exactly is it that you'd like me to say to make you happy?
Everything you say makes me happy. Most of what you say makes me happy, actually. Now, you just made a comment a couple weeks ago.
No, you sounded like a younger woman who was a lib, you know, an Obamaite who wanted me to sound like a fool. No, but really, what are you actually asking?
I'm asking why I don't hear you speak about it more. And don't you think it's one of the major contributors to the downfall of our society, besides liberalism?
Oh, you want me to be a conservative, old fuddy-duddy railing against space, MySpace, and all of that?
No,
well, I'm not going to do it. I mean, I don't particularly go online to talk to people. I would rather talk to them in person. There are those who do, and it's just another way of meeting people. I don't see anything wrong with it. Eventually, they have to meet each other, where their human qualities or lack thereof will show. I think it's a more efficient way than going to a bar, for example, and talking to 10,000 strangers until you meet your wife.
All right, I'll give you that.
I'm saying, like, you know, I watch some of these eHarmony ads. You know, I don't know whether to believe them or not. You know, see happy couples. I don't believe it for a minute. But I would believe that if a person sends in a, you know, here I am, I like this. This is the, like, what would your colors I like and music I like and I like whales and I like, you know, trees and I like guns and all. So you meet a woman like that. Yeah, that's a good start. Can you imagine the amount of time you have to spend randomly trying to meet someone who you have to get through all of that with? So in that sense, I think it's a wonderful way to cut through so many wasted dates, for example.
What about the
cell phones? What's wrong with a cell phone? It's revolutionized communication. I think it's phenomenal. I know people who run billion-dollar businesses on cell phones. They can be anywhere in the world, and they're not imprisoned. It's freed people rather than imprisoned them.
You think so?
I know so. Well, I have a friend right now who's on vacation in a tropical paradise, still running a company that does a tremendous amount of business. This individual could not do this if he didn't have a cell phone and a BlackBerry.
But you don't think people are kind of walking around hypnotized entranced by their little BlackBerries and cell phones, and they can't leave the house without them?
Yeah, but you have less time for neurosis this way. There's less time to fear things. If you're on your BlackBerry with two thumbs, there's less time to worry about the eternal questions. This is much better this way. You just live thinking that you're conquering the universe by pressing keys on a BlackBerry. It's far better than facing the eternal questions that I had to face. You see that? I got you to laugh. I got you. So I take it you're not happy with all these technologies.
I think it's making people very dumb. I think they don't read as much as they used to.
Read? Why are you kidding me? They're reading BlackBerries. They're reading telegram messages on BlackBerries. No need for punctuation. No need for any kind of articulation. It's wonderful. Everyone's been reduced to the level of an ignorant rap musician. What could be better? You talk about democracy. Everyone's now down to a first grade level. What could be better?
It's cutting across all party lines. It's tripartisanship.
So have you tried to find a mate on one of these space pages or whatever?
Oh, I don't know. I met my husband in a bar, so, and we've been married for...
Okay. Thank you for the low blow. Women always win. But that was easy. I wanted you to give me a good gut shot.
I'm a big fan, and I'm not a lib. I'm articulate, but I'm not a lib.
And you also sound like you're a lib. That's the you could be a great reversal. You could really be. You could do a lot of damage to them up in Spokane. Thanks for being a good sport on the Savage Nation. So I have nothing. I have in my pocket, but I carry the old and the new technology in my pocket. I have, of course, a cell phone. It's people laugh at it. The young ones snicker. Look at that man with a fat cell phone. You know, they think slimmer makes them smarter. I love it. I just love it. What I love is you go into a hotel lobby where there's a bar, which I will do on occasion in San Francisco, and you see the poor young people, they're staring into their palm as though it's sort of a crystal ball. And in this crystal ball is all of their future and all of their hopes and dreams are tied up in their hand. And, of course, everyone's pretending that they're meeting someone there and that they just showed up a little early, even though they're looking for someone. And the chances of them meeting someone are diminished by the fact that they're not looking at anyone while they're really looking for someone, because they're looking into the palm of their hand to pretend that they're actually meeting someone. So as I say, I mean, certainly that inhibits the chance of meeting someone when you're looking into your own hand as though the future lies in your hand. I also, as a social observer, every time I walk past a telephone store now, I laugh to myself. I do have my own sense of humor, which keeps me going here. I walk past, like, Verizon, and it's always the same kind of, like, icky, creepy guys that look like they might be, you know, Pee Wee Herman's on the side. I don't know, like tight pants, weird haircuts, pointy shoes, and kind of like freaky faces. And you see women, you see people sitting at desks with them as though they're in confessionals. Go and look at the people in these Verizon stores as they talk to one of these creepy Pee Wee Herman salesmen about their telephonic needs. And it's as though they're in a confessional or in a psychiatrist's office of 10 years ago, and they're leaning over with their heart on their hand, and this is what I need, and this is what I'm looking for. And the guy's like, I think I have just the exact... This is their whole world is wrapped up in the latest thin telephonic device, which I can never understand. I feel as though I've landed on a strange planet. So in many ways, I do enjoy the current society. It's entertaining for me to look at these things as they go on. Devices, sure, I live on the computer. I'm on 12 hours a day. I'm going blind from it. Cell phone, I have a pocket watch that's not digital. It has a second hand and actual hands that glow in the dark, and it's round like a railroad guy's watch. It's a Timberland Swiss something or other, I don't know, watch from 20 years ago. I like to look at the time as the hand goes around. I didn't tell you this. What a great call for this. I also collect antique clocks. I don't have many. I like French bronze marble and such 19th century, early 20th century French three-piece sets. Okay, I have a few of them, and they're all running well. Well, this is strange. One of them, which I've had for 5 years, I bought at auction 10 years ago for $600. It was a steal because it was designed for the export market by the French in the 1890s, and it was designed for export probably to Syria or Egypt because it's designed like a mosque. And it's astounding. And both of the two side candelabra pieces are like little minarets, and the design of the blue the green alabaster marble is that of a mosque. It's gorgeous. And as I say, the French design for overseas markets, it ran fine for 6 years. About a week ago, it stopped running. I happen to be in flux right now. I'm not going to disclose where, but I'm going to be moving to an undisclosed state and an undisclosed location part-time. Back and forth. No one's going to know where I am and when, and I'm not going to tell you why, where, or how. And it's as though this clock is a pet. It stopped running. I swear to God, I think that clocks have souls. I know that sounds crazy, but I know that pets have souls because they behave weirdly, too, when they know you're leaving them or you're ditching them or you're not thinking right about them. They start, you know, like peeing in strange places in your house, hopefully not in your shoes while you're sleeping at night. But again, even my dog is acting up, and I have to tell him, look, if you keep it up, you're not coming with me. Naturally, that makes him more nervous, so he does more of the sneaky stuff. And then I say, well, you're not coming with me, so he does it again that night. So it's a vicious circle. But the fact of the matter is, I also collect the antique clocks. And yesterday, last night, I had my clocksmith come over. I'm not going to divulge his name nor his story. But after work, I went home and I asked this clocksmith who came over, who was trained. You want to believe this story? Here he is working on my clock. He has a screwdriver that's a German screwdriver, maybe 70 years old. I look at it immediately and see the quality of the machining on the screwdriver. I know it wasn't made in China out of pressed steel. And I show him some tools that my father left for me when he died. You won't believe how beautiful these things are. And we're talking about tools and clocks and watches. And I said, didn't you have to apprentice to become a clocksmith? He said, yes, I did. He said, I had to become an apprentice for several years. And in order to pass the apprenticeship exam, I had to make a clock. We all did. I said, well, when you die off, I mean, he's an elderly gentleman. Are there any people around who still can fix a clock? He said, surprisingly few. And that's it. So I said, I don't know. All these clocks are going to stop and not run again because there's no one learning how to fix a clock. Now, why would somebody waiting online in New York City in the freezing rain for a job with DHS, ICE, or FBI want to learn how to fix a clock when they might actually have to go to school, master a trade, pass an exam, when in the option they could just simply go to work and sit on their behinds as though they're still in college, go out at night and get drunk and come to work in the morning and try to capture Osama bin Laden or his minions before they set off another bomb in the subway? Don't get me started. I know what's going on. I try to warn you, but I failed. I admit my failure. I failed. 15 years I've tried to warn you that diversity is a cover for perversity. But I failed. You didn't listen to me. You were led to believe that it's just an alternative lifestyle. It has no effect on the people themselves. You were led to believe that anything goes because you were told that anything goes. I warned you what would happen. This is Dr. Dissident Michael Savage back in a moment. Savage. Get an acid start. I ate filet mignon, which I never eat because I'm into low saturated fat for 40 years now, and I'm still living, by the way. I eat meat once in a while, very seldom, not much. For 30 years, I didn't eat it. Then when I got into radio, my diet went to the garbage can. I started saying, okay, I started when I was the tension and stress of talk radio is so high that you tend to slip. So I slipped back into sort of bad food habits, figuring I would die younger than I would have if I didn't go into radio, and I continued to eat the Spartan diet and exercise. Who wanted to live that way, though? You ever see these guys 70 or in perfect shape? Do you want to live like them? What are they alive for? To just be alive. All right, there's a certain spite in living to live. I understand that as well, but it's like a living death. They look at the watch. They're lean. All right, fine. Looks abnormal to me, men at a certain age, to be so gaunt. It looks like they have consumption. A normal man doesn't look like that with, like, gaunt L.A. look. That L.A. lawyer look. You ever see that L.A., like, upscale L.A. lawyer look where it's gaunt and exercised? They look like they're high on cocaine all the time anyway. Or speed. That's why they're gaunt. They don't eat. All they do is drink vodka at night and look for sex. But I'm getting off the track. So I went in this. I didn't eat meat for years. I hated that I didn't eat meat. When the kids were young, all I wanted was a steak. But I know you can't die young. You leave them alone. They won't have a father. You can't eat. Run. A miserable time till I got them to a point where they were self-sufficient. Then I could go back to my own needs and my own career. I found talk radio, blah, blah, blah. And then I had to start eating in order, like an opera star. You have to feed an opera star. Opera star has to be fed. In order for me to talk loud, in order for me to have the power I need for radio, I need a man's diet, not a sissy diet. I don't need a tofu, vegetarian, sissified diet. I need a man's diet. I need alcohol. I need beef. I need potatoes. You know what I'm saying? That's what I went into. Not every day. I'd be dead, but a little. But I still don't eat a lot of steak, hardly once a year. But yesterday, admittedly, 2 days in a row, I got filet mignon. I put them on the grill. They were so good, I almost cried. I almost wept. You say, well, why don't you eat them every day? Because I know better. Because man is not made to eat meat every day like that. Period. End of story. Today we're going to go from Sartre to the Sizzler, meaning, well, that's the passage in America, from Sartre to the Sizzler. It started out with him reading Sartre, Hemingway, Henry Miller. He did his big trip to Europe. He walked along the Seine, shopped in the bookstalls, stayed in the pensions, love in the afternoon, across the river and into the trees, for whom the bell tolls, a farewell to arms, Hemingway, sailfish, Cuba, Fiji, exploration, the heights, authorship. It ends in the Sizzler along the highway. He can't restaurants anymore. He can't
run the whole thing
anymore. He can't take owners who talk too much and produce so little. The Sizzler, the last stop on the train, from Sartre to the Sizzler without the sizzle.
Here's
the
good part.
How it ends. The 6 ounce senior steak. I'm sorry. The 6 ounce senior steak special, $9.95, or you can eat salad bar included, plus a baked potato. The meat tasted as though it had been killed during the Roosevelt administration. In a cold storage locker in Denver since 1945. In a government warehouse purchased by the Sizzler's owner from the war profiteer's grandson. In a New York stock trade. Sizzler, Spitzer, 6 ounce steak, killed in 1945. That's how it ends. Sizzler, 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 without the sizzle, without the Sartre. Reaching for the stars and ending up on a rocking horse. Trying to ride a thunderbolt to heaven and ending up in an air-conditioned Prius. from a Vespa to a Mercedes. From flying boats to frying oats. From flying fish to Gorton's fish sticks. From Marx's dialectics to Bush's dyslexics. From a vicious chow to a poodle now. From metaphysics to Metamucil. From deep conversation to TV vibrations. From Tonga's beaches to Miami Beach. From metaphysics to Metamucil. From a rowboat to a powerboat. From Columbia River salmon jumping in the sun to packaged lox without fun. From jumping out of airplanes to creeping in the slow lane. From skiing down Mount Rose to holding garden hose. From scooters in Mallorca to Hooters in a Walker. From Sartre to the Sizzler. Somewhat melancholic, but so what? What does everything have to be? Upbeat and ha-ha. I write from Sartre to the Sizzler and do talk radio. It's my therapy. Who is not struggling with depression listening to this show? Depression is part of life. I don't understand where this came up. You know, when you turn a normal human emotion into a disease, you can open up the Pandora's box of treatments. You can sell drugs for it. You can sell therapy for it. How about calling it a normal human emotion? I would think that if a person isn't depressed right now with this charlatan in the presidency, that they're psychotic. I would say anyone who's not depressed with Obama in the White House and Axelrod and Rahm Emanuel and the others around him and what they're doing to this country, I think you're crazy if you're not depressed. 1-800-449-8255. If you want to talk about the Sartre to the Sizzler and what it means to you. New York City, WOR, Bob, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Hey, Mike. Oh, man, listen to that monologue. That was great. I'm a 24-year-old grad student at Queens College.
College, my Bachelor of Science degree, alma mater.
I'm proud.
It used to be a great school. It was very tough. Is it hard again?
The standards have declined.
After I graduated a long time ago, 1959, my God, it's forever ago. Wait a minute, no, that was high school. What am I talking about? College was, 66 or something? I don't remember, 63 rather, 63. And at that time, the Queens College curriculum was equal to the University of Chicago. It was the 100 great books. They copied the same curriculum. You had to pass in two foreign languages to get a degree. It was really a tough school. Then they had open admissions in order to make sure that the college looked like New York. And as a result, it looked like New York with graffiti on the walls. And it went into total decline as a result of the open admissions policies. You know. Houston, Texas. Adam, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Hey, I agree with your comment about depression. I wake up. The hardest part every day for me is waking up depressed. And I know there's a part of me that knows that everyone deals with it one way or another. So when
that's
I hear
right. You live with it. You live with it. You struggle through it. And most of life is overcoming depression for an average person.
I agree. And it's good to hear you say that because it affirms what I already knew to be true.
I have struggled against depression my entire life. So what? I've never taken drugs for it. Never. What I found years ago, there are other methods of dealing with it, with my natural inherent sadness about life. And that's my way of life. I look at life as a very sad journey. I don't think life is very happy. I don't think life is ha-ha. I don't think it's Disneyland. And you can go under from it. You can become a drug addict from it. You know, you can do a lot of things. But I found that a long time ago, and I struggled for a long time to find the methods. There are many things you can do that aside from drugs to fight through depression, such as apply yourself and work. Do something meaningful. Devote yourself to somebody other than yourself. There are 100 things you can do, if not 1,000 things you can do, that do not require therapy and drugs. That's all. I don't understand. Everybody, you have to hide it? What's there to hide? Life is very tragic. If you lead an ordinary life, tragic things happen to you. Or if they don't happen to you, they happen in your family. If they don't happen in your family, they happen to your neighbor, you know, or your neighborhood. Okay, so you're not listening to this show to hear this. You want entertainment because it's Friday and you want something, you know, joking and uplifting and rock and roll Friday. I understand that. But this is not generically a ha-ha show. It's a different story. That's all.
Savage.